Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. Joined today in the studio by Simon Thompson. How are you doing, Simon?
I'm well, John. Better than last week.
I'm glad to hear it. It sounded nasty.
Well, you were very sympathetic from memory.
I am sympathetic, generally. We're going to be talking about some of your writings this week, some of your many writings, despite your bad neck.
Despite the bad neck, I've actually written up about 15 companies this week, John.
Okay, so we'll come on to that shortly. Also, Megan Boxall, how are you doing, Megan?
Very well, thanks, John.
Excellent, and you've written quite a lot this week.
I have, not 15 companies worth, though.
That's quite a few.
Yeah.
Some important stories,
which we will discuss.
But in the tech sector in particular, yeah. Which I think is has political ramifications as well, which I'm sure we will get
on to.
Exciting. Yes, indeed. And Julia Forshaw, how are you doing, Julia?
Good, thanks, John.
Excellent. The stars of a line this week, so we actually have the person who's written the cover feature here in the studio. So we're going to talk about that. It's about IPOs.
That's right.
Which are interesting, often... an opportunity to make some money, as we discover, but also an opportunity to lose some money.
Yeah, it can really go either way.
It can go either way, and what you've done is try and work out how you can avoid going the wrong way.
Yeah, certain factors to look for that could signify that it might go well instead of badly.
Okay, we'll come on to that very shortly. Should we start with the news this week? Let's start with you, Megan. Imagination Technology.
Mm, yeah, finally they've had an offer.
Yeah, finally. I mean, I took the liberty of printing out their share price charts.
Very organised. Got a tie on.
Unusually. You've got to dress up for the listeners. Imagination Technologies is one of the UK's few remaining big tech companies.
Yeah.
And it's being bought by a Chinese company.
Yeah, well, potentially. That's the that would be ideal for the shareholders at the moment.
So how far are we down the road with this takeover?
It's an official offer which has been accepted by the directors, but they weren't really going to reject it because they put themselves up for sale in June. It was a pretty generous offer. And from what we sort of understand at the moment is it may well have to be scrutinised by the government. We're not sure yet.
This is what I can't get my head around. Why?
The argument is that the company, it's a venture capital firm. It's backed by a Chinese company.
Mm-hmm.
And it's,
which is a state-owned Chinese company as well.
State-owned Chinese company. And so it's called Canyon Bridge. And about 2 weeks ago, it was blocked from buying a very similar company in the US based on state security issues.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of see the argument for the US because the tech business is enormous in America. There is so much riding on the tech industry that you can sort of see where the argument's there for blocking the Chinese-backed venture capital firm from buying a very large tech firm. Because that deal was blocked in the US, there are members of parliament, members of the shadow cabinet, there are members of the public who are saying that our government should do the same thing and assess whether or not this deal is a matter of public of
national interest,
and state security.
I find that rather difficult to believe because Imagination Technologies, the problems it's having are mainly because it really was very reliant upon one customer.
Yeah.
That customer was Apple,
yeah.
Who also had a big stake, if I remember rightly, for some time. Do they still have that stake?
Yeah, they still have that stake. It's not worth quite as much as it used to be.
No, and obviously they don't care how much it's worth. It was kind of a strategic stake for a supplier of a certain chip, graphics chip, that they needed, but they don't really care. The share price has... I mean, you say it's a generous offer, but the share price is significantly below where it was
four or five, six years ago. The reason I think it's a generous offer is because roughly 50% of Imagination's revenues come from Apple. And from as soon as people start buying the iPhone 8 and the iPhone 10... Those sales are going to completely plummet.
Mm.
And it's probably going to move back into a net debt position. And then it's got its banking covenants to worry about. And so there's really not an awful lot of Imagination to like, apart from the core technology, which is meant to be fantastic. I mean, it's been part of the iPhones for the last 10 years. It probably is.
But not irreplaceable, clearly.
Clearly not irreplaceable. And also clearly not good enough for, while the share price has been completely hammered, for another big tech company to come and buy it up. I mean, you'd have thought.
Well, there was a second party potentially,
wasn't there? There was, yeah. But we don't know who that was.
And they pulled out.
And they've pulled out, yeah. Too much confusion on Wednesday morning.
But yeah, I saw you were running around.
but it wasn't Canyon Bridge that pulled out. It was, this other company. But if the technology was good enough, why did Samsung not come make an offer? Why did another mobile phone provider, or like a Google or an Amazon, people who are looking at virtual reality, if the graphics are that good in these chips, then why were they not made an offer for someone like that rather than a company which, all what Canyon Bridge do is sweep up the tech companies that no one else really wants and put a load of money into them.
Yeah, and they make chips very cheaply, I assume, for domestic Chinese handset makers or whatever it might be. I mean, it is interesting as well. I mean, in the political context, because obviously a couple of years back now, we saw ARM fall to a Japanese buyer, SoftBank. Yeah. So, you know, there wasn't a lot of objections to that deal at the time.
No, and because one of the reasons for that was because SoftBank was all about like growing the UK business and investing in the infrastructure in the UK. But since that's happened, there's been a lot more backlash to us allowing one of our last big tech companies to go. Now we've got Aveva going as well. I mean, they're all just falling by the wayside.
I mean, you know, the reason I printed off these share price charts is because I know this company. I've known it, you know, for a long time. It's been around, you know, since well before the dot-com boom. And it's been a roller coaster.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not, I mean, it's not been a strategically important supplier. There have been questions over what it does for a long, long time. Aveva, similarly, I mean, it does a good, you know, an interesting thing. CAD design for oil and gas and shipbuilding, but it's been a roller coaster ride.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they both have been. And in Imagination's case, I definitely would agree that it's time for it to go. It's not a massive loss, I don't think, to the UK tech sector because it hasn't been run very well. I mean, to rely 50% of your revenues on one customer is crazy. And anyone would know that that's just not a good way to run a business. So I don't think that this is a massive loss. We've got so many tech companies, but if it becomes like common for all of our tech companies to be disappearing off to Asia, that's not great for the growth in the UK tech sector.
But isn't that the nature of kind of British capitalism? You know, the British approach to the way we allow our markets to operate is that we are open to foreign capital. We are open to foreign takeovers. It's a kind of neutral thing. And I think there was a great quote from someone involved in one of these deals saying basically it's a matter for the company.
Yeah.
It's a financial decision.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely, and that is completely fair enough. But if it becomes sort of normal, if our tech companies aren't growing enough, if you look at the US, the economy that's being created by the tech companies, you've got Google and Apple, which are phenomenal companies, and then you've got Europe saying, "Oh, they have too much of a domination in the market." Well, no one's competing with them because all that's happening is they're being bought into these massive companies.
Indeed, but you don't create industries by protecting suppliers who are perhaps not worth protecting.
Well, yeah, in this case, in Imagination's case, I would definitely say that, yeah, it's not really worth hanging on to it.
Indeed, and in the case of ARM, I mean, you know, that's still in Cambridge and it still has this big kind of, what would you call it, an ecosystem of companies around it. You know, it still is an important part of the tech economy in the UK, and foreign ownership does nothing to change that.
No, that is true. But it isn't our company, which is
ours. It belongs to the shareholders.
Yeah, who are now Japanese shareholders.
But look at any company on the market, and you know it will have on its shareholder base significant numbers of overseas investors.
Definitely an argument.
It's a good one. I like it.
Just about to add that if we're quite happy for our utilities to be owned by overseas investors stroke countries, and we're reliant on capital from them for basically our energy needs, then why should we have an issue with Imagination Technologies being owned by the Chinese?
Well, indeed. I mean, I think there are some objections to the way that British utilities are owned, and certainly around the water sector, which we cover in this week's Sector Focus. You know, I think there is a political issue there with the way profits from utilities flow overseas, and train companies, for example, both of these being the subject of discussion at the recent Labour Party conference. However, we want to build a new nuclear power station. We need the foreign capital.
Yeah, so that's one of the arguments with the Imagination thing as well. So there's been China's putting money into a nuclear power station in Cumbria also this week, and that's all kind of coming into the argument that we need to protect our British growth from Chinese.
Or we just need their money.
Maybe we wouldn't need their money if we allowed our tech companies to grow in the way that Apple and Amazon and Google have done.
Yes, but they can grow themselves. That's for them to work out how to do. It's not for the government to determine how the direction of companies grow.
Yeah.
But anyway, we're getting into philosophical realms, which I don't think we have time to do justice to on this podcast. Julia, you've written quite a lot of results this week. Peter Cussons in the news section.
Yes, that's right.
I've always been skeptical. I like this company, but I've always felt it's been in a bit of a tricky spot. And things haven't gotten easier this week.
Cost inflation has been a really difficult one for them, and especially since this has outstripped wage growth. And so management were warning that these factors, kind of in conjunction with a broader economic uncertainty, are causing a lot of their consumers to shop more cautiously. And so, and the washing and bathing products that they've launched over the period, they've noticed that consumers have been quite aware of the price point on them, and they haven't really maybe done particularly as well as they had hoped.
Yeah, I mean, this feels like the kind of consumer squeeze we saw, you know, sort of 2008, 2009, where the own branded suppliers started to pick up a lot of share because people were becoming much, much more price conscious.
Yeah, as wages aren't keeping up with this cost inflation, people are going to say, maybe I won't buy the brand name anymore. Maybe I'll go for the own brand of wherever it is they're shopping instead. So this has managed to hurt PZ Cousins over the time.
Yeah, I mean, the argument that the likes of PZ Cousins would have had, and they make things like Imperial Leather and Original Source, I think, is one
of
theirs, which I like. Their argument was, you know, people are much more circumspect about what they put on their body rather than sort of, you know, generic own brand household cleaning products, for example, which someone like McBride makes a lot of. But that may not be the case then anymore. The branded product is not necessarily going to win.
Yeah, no, it seems to be slipping into the poor side of the cycle where people are maybe not picking the branded products anymore.
I think this is a bit of a lead indicator for a consumer squeeze. I mean, talking of branded products, Unilever, for example, you know, maybe they're seeing that actually in countries like the UK, where you are seeing a bit of a squeeze on the branded products, the growth is going to be elsewhere. They've bought someone this week in quite an interesting deal.
Yes, they have. They're looking to increase their stake in North Asia. So they've bought this company called Carver Korea. And it was previously owned by Goldman Sachs and Bain Capital. And so it's kind of have a private equity injection of some money. But yeah, it's the fastest growing skincare company in South Korea, according to Unilever anyway. But yeah, it's the South Korean skincare market has been a massive market at the time. It's one of the fastest growing in the world right now. And so Unilever have clearly spotted an opportunity and want to pick up on that.
Quite expensive shares still, though, aren't they?
They are rather expensive, yes.
Indeed.
That's why we've got it on hold at the moment. They're making acquisitions. They've also recently bought the UK company Puka Herbs. And so
they bought what?
They specialise in herbal teas. And as consumers are moving to be a bit more health conscious, they're picking herbal teas maybe instead of their coffees. Yeah, so they recently also bought that as well. And so, yeah, Unilever is good for spotting these kind of emerging trends and really picking companies that are already quite well established in that space.
Obviously not too worried about the political tensions on the Korean Peninsula either, if they're spending all that money to move in there. Okay, so let's quickly run through some of the results and tip updates we've had this week. There's a couple that you've written, Julia, that both good tips, one sell, one buy. Let's start with the buy, Compass. That's been a great performer. Some interesting news there that might worry shareholders, but we're not so worried.
Yeah, they've had some management changes at the moment. So their long-standing chief executive, Richard Cousins, has announced that he will step down from the end of March next year. And he's been at the helm of the company for 11 years now. So shareholders have come to trust him quite heavily. And the share price has done extremely well over the time. It started off at around 240p when he took over, and last I checked it was trading just over 1500. So shareholders have been clearly quite pleased with him over that time.
But we're not worried, we still like the shares despite the change of management?
Yeah, we do. I mean, the fellow who's taking over, Dominic Blakemore, he has been chief financial officer at the company for 4 years already, and so, you know, knows the ins and outs of what's going on.
He knows
so he should be good, capable hands for it to go into. So this certainly, while the former chief executive has done quite well, this shouldn't be really cause for concern, I don't think.
No, it's still in a secular trend of outsourced food service, which we like. Mrs. Butler, talking of food and drinks, we sold this and it was right.
Yeah.
And they've had an update. What's happening here?
The English summer was unfortunately as rainy as it gets that reputation
It was quite dismal.
And so, which was sending fewer people to the pubs. They were buying less pints.
I know, I still went
to the
pub.
Which is just overall. Well, apparently not as many other people did. And so
more fool
that
there.
Was bad news for Mitchells and Butlers.
I spent all my money at Adnams in Southwold. Literally all of my money.
Any recommendations?
Any recommendations from Southwold? I would say that they're distilling operation is going from strength to strength, and their gins are absolutely fantastic. You went out that way, didn't you, Megan?
Yeah, well, Albra Thorpe Ness, but a little bit further.
Close enough, all the pubs in Albra are Adams.
They're all Adams, yeah. And it's great. And I really like all of their like pale ales and the whole range now. They're not just relying on that dark stuff, which I'm not that keen on.
No, no.
Ghost Ship's delicious.
Yeah, that's a huge beer. A huge, huge beer.
Yeah, I didn't
beer.
Realise how big it was.
Yeah, yeah.
It's great. It's everywhere. Amazing. Do they have pubs as well, or do they just make beer?
They've got pubs. Pubs, hotels in Southwold and Aldbury. Yeah. They are great. They are great. But as I said, I'm broke
you
after
mix
that
your
summer.
Gin, you mix your Adnams gin with Fever Tree tonic. It's a great drink.
I actually made my own gin at Adnams.
Yeah. What, did you go around the factory?
We had a look at the factory.
Oh, yeah. I'd like to do that. I've never done that.
I was kind of regressing my career choices when I saw when I met the head distiller. But I love this. I love this. Let's quickly turn to the results section, as I said. What do we have in there? Megan, anything you've covered this week that really stood out?
Cambion was surprisingly good. Cambion is the care homes operator, which had an absolute disaster in 2016 and sold its children's services, so they're the care homes for children, side of the business, which was the bit that was doing really well. I had concerns that with just the adult division left, they'd be not an awful lot left to invest in. But actually, they've come through the period of transition pretty well, and they're growing not badly.
So these are care homes, basically, are they?
Yeah, yeah. Specialist homes and schools as well. Well, it used to be schools for people with learning difficulties and elderly people.
Well, I can't see. I mean, care homes has been an interesting sector. I mean, Simon, when you were back in the days of your company editorship, I mean, the care home sector struggled badly. So things like Southern Cross that really ran into trouble.
The two reasons for that: one, most of them were highly indebted, over leveraged. Secondly, they were susceptible to local authorities funding. So they were basically squeezed on both fronts. However, the niche ones like CareTech, which is specialist services, have done fantastically well. And the independents, some of those are actually doing well as well. A relative owns 5 care homes now, and she is making a fortune.
Yeah, I think don't say that too loudly, because if Jeremy Corbyn's listening, those 5 care homes may not be making quite so much money.
Well, she's making a fortune. However, I'm told that the quality of care represents decent value for what she's actually offering too.
We've been actually, next week's cover feature is about long term care and how you actually fund it. It's a big thing. It's a big objective of many investors.
The market is unfortunately growing like massively.
The population is getting older.
Population is getting older, and living longer. We've got people who are going to be in care homes for 10 years, which would have been unheard of 20 years ago. But we need to have more space to look after those people. And if you've got the right business model, like you say, CareTech's just got it absolutely right. And it's not taking on too much debt, which is what Cambion's problem was.
Well, it seems that it's got net cash, looking at this.
Well, now it does, because it sold...
Because
it sold like half of its business.
So it's going to be reinvesting there.
Yeah.
Fine.
Before it sold its children's care division, it had serious amount of debt, and it breached its banking covenants, which was why it had so many issues last year. But it seems to be on better grounds now, and the results were pretty good.
Hey, Rose and I have looked at this. I mean, there is obviously political interest in this sector as well, because, I mean, it was part of the election pledges of the Tory, and I think it was one of the pledges, the care cost pledge, that really backfired on them. However, Rosie and I looked into this, and there is this idea that care homes basically charge the earth and are rampantly profiteering, but actually they cost a lot of money to run.
A huge amount of money to run. They have to, because you need the insurance, you need to pay your staff, and that's one of the things that's hurting them a lot at the moment. The government increased the amount that people have to be paid if they're working overnight in a care home. And because that cost has risen, and so you have to have carers overnight. So
we're not massively bullish on this. Because
we're not bullish in any way. But I mean, we were kind of like, this company is not going to exist in 5 years, but now it probably is. It seems to be back on track.
Okay, Julia, what have you covered this week that piqued your interest?
Deep Eurasia was interesting.
I was hoping you were going to say that.
Hoping I was going to say that, or wasn't going to say that.
I love this story.
Yeah, it's their first set of results as a listed company too, and so
DP is basically Domino's Pizza.
That's right. Yes, And so, and the Eurasia bit is they're mainly in Turkey and Russia at the moment. But they, it was a good set of results. They're looking to go quite quickly. When they hit the market, they were raising money primarily to expand the number of stores that they can operate in Russia. And so far they're doing that. They've opened stores over the period. Profits are up and they're looking to continue to expand.
And they've got plenty of money to do that? Or are they going to be coming back to shareholders to fund that growth?
For the moment, it should be good. I mean, their franchise model is fairly... it's not too expensive to run for them if they're having franchise money coming in. And so they should be good for the meantime. But, I mean, you never know in the future there. If they said that they're going to focus on Russia and Turkey for now, but they could expand into more markets in Eastern Europe in the future.
And they're talking about 2,500 stores.
Yeah, they...
It's a big number.
That is a big number, especially since they're just over the 600 threshold now. So they've got...
That's still quite big.
That is still quite a lot of stores, especially in Eastern Europe. But so if their plans go ahead and go as they're expecting, then there could be quite a lot of room for growth.
Yeah, I mean, it's the third Domino's Pizza incarnation that we've seen on the market. So we've obviously had Domino's Pizza in UK and Ireland, which has done exceptionally well.
That's right.
And
the much smaller existence of DP Poland.
DP Poland, yeah. I went on a fact-finding mission for DP Poland.
What did you find?
Not a lot of DPs.
How was pizza?
I didn't have one. I couldn't find any.
Is Polish Domino's any different from British Domino's?
I don't know. I didn't find any. No, my wife has family in Poland, so and this was just as DP Poland was coming to market. So I went out there and sort of I asked my wife's cousin, "Now, do you like pizza? Do you get any?" And I think he just had no idea what I was talking about.
I looked at it a few years ago, and if you'd actually invested in it, you'd have done tremendously well in the last 2 or 3 years.
Really?
300-400% share price gain. But I didn't get it because I've been to Poland, and the wages that people have, yes, I know the demographic is a lot younger than Britain, you know, post Second World War and et cetera, but the income and the prices charged in Britain compared with Poland and the type of margins you're making, I didn't get the operational gearing in the business. And, you know, the last I looked, it's doing a lot better than it was, but I still don't get it, to be honest.
No, I didn't really get it. I mean, Poland, Warsaw, which is where I think they really began their operation. I mean, you know, there's plenty of food options out there. There is Polish fast food, which is really nice. Zappy Kanki.
Bit of a mouthful.
It's basically a bit of a French bread cut in half. Stale. Has to be stale. With like
You're not selling it.
with onions, cheese and tomato sauce on it. Put it in the oven for a little bit.
That sounds like a pizza.
It is a pizza. It's a French bread pizza and it's amazing. And they cost nothing. And this goes back to what you're saying, Simon. Poland, you know, it's cheap to eat out there.
We went to Krakow, okay, this was 7-8 years ago, and we were eating out for next to nothing. And we weren't on a budget. We were trying to spend money, but it was actually quite difficult.
Your best option might have been DP Poland.
If I could have found one. But that's the point that, you know, you're looking at the margins that you can make from an individual outlet and the cash profits you can make and then roll out the franchise. And I didn't get it, but clearly there's something there. Otherwise, the share price wouldn't have done so well in the last few years.
And you would expect the same to be true of these Eurasian markets that DP Eurasia is going into. Much lower cost in terms of the products, the price they can get for it. But the same sort of, you know, broader pressures on input costs that everyone else has. So,
is there not an aspect of DP Poland just riding the share price of Domino's Pizza?
I don't think so. I think they are treated very much as separate businesses. I mean, I don't think you look at... So, I mean, Domino's Pizza obviously has a very large US master franchise. And I can't... You know, when we've looked at the prospects for Domino's UK, I don't ever remember thinking about looking at the US business. It's very different. It's just a different market.
Yeah, totally different markets.
And obviously Domino's UK has then tried to expand into Europe itself through Germany. And, you know, it's finding that they're very different markets to go into. But it is very interesting. The spread of Domino's.
So is it worth having a slice of it?
Oh, here we go. It's good to have you back, Simon.
We're saying hold at the moment, so wait and see.
So not worth a slice. All right, Simon, okay. tell us what is worth a slice this week.
I've had a cracking week. I produced on Monday a column called Exploiting Hidden Value. And that's online only, I stress, but there's 6 companies, 4,500 words of analysis and some special situations there to look over. But for the magazine column this week, Plain Sailing, I looked at 4 companies, one of which, GYG, which stands for Global Yachting Group, floated on the market 2 months ago. I had the board of directors on the phone for about an hour and a half before it actually floated, going through the business. Admission document was, you know, 150 pages, and I went through it with a fine tooth comb. Decided, Zeus Capital was the brokerage behind this, decided that the flotation price of £1, a target price of £1.50, was realistic. Results this week, maiden results, have actually upgraded that target price to nearer £1.70.
What does it do?
It is the global leader in new build and refit super yacht painting. That's it. It paints super yachts. And it does about 167 refits a year, but each one costs, wait for it, €200,000. But if you've got a super yacht worth 100, 200 million euros, what's 200,000 euros? It's nothing. Some of these super yachts charter for 300, 400,000 euros a week.
Once again, I'm ruining my career choice.
But not surprisingly, the only people that can actually afford to own these super yachts are billionaires. And there's a correlation between the business that GYG gets and the number of billionaires in the world,
which is growing.
It's grown, well, between 1995 and 2015, it grew fivefold to over 1,800 billionaires. Industry experts expect it to actually grow to 2,500 billionaires within 3 years. So it's a strong, strong trend there. And this company is doing incredibly well. It's got an order pipeline of €385 million worth of work. It's got a historical conversion rate of 32% of that. Its order book is going great guns. Remy Millot, the chief executive, told me that they've got so many requests for work, they've had to take on 2 extra staff in the recent weeks, which gives you some indication of the pipeline that's actually building behind those official figures. Profits were up strongly in the first half. Zeus expects 39% profit growth for the full year. Shares are trading roughly 12 times earnings estimates for the full year. But the other thing this company is actually doing is taking costs out of the business. It was private equity owned previously. Lonsdale Partners own 20% of thereabouts of the equity still. As a result of this pipeline and lower cost base, profits are going to absolutely ratchet up next year too. This stock is roughly 10.5 times next year's earnings. It's got a big fat dividend yield too, because it's a very asset-light business. They enter into relationships with boatyards and hire out space, have seasonal workers paint these super yachts. So it's an asset-light business with high conversion of cash flow into operating profits, and it supports a really chunky dividend. As I said, you know, stock price has gone from £1 to about £1.35-40 this week. I've increased my target price to £1.70, so another 20% or so upside. That would equate to about 15 times next year's earnings estimates and a prospective dividend yield at that target price of 3.8%. I like it a lot.
I mean, this is quite interesting, and I think we'll come back to you, Simon, because I think you know, GYG, as you said, you know, is a recently new entrant to the market. you poured over its prospectus, made the decision to buy, and obviously that chimes very, very nicely with what you've been looking at this week in the cover feature.
That's right.
So I mean, I guess we've now got this. We can ask Simon, as an investor, having looked at the prospectus, which is one of the first things you encourage people to do. But yeah, talk us through, you know, what did you find from, you know, how you actually approached the idea of investing in a newly listed business? What are the kind of key things that you came away with?
I mean, when investors can see these new companies coming to market, it's often easy to get overly keen and think this is a great new opportunity, it'll be the next big thing. But the features looking at sort of what factors you should be aware of and what might be indicative of how the company's run and how it might perform in the future. And so, first of all, I guess the first thing people have to look at is, do you understand what the company does? Do you know what kind of market share they have? Do they? How is their product or their service different from others that are on the market? Or
I kind of like this one. What do you know? What the company does? Paints boats.
That's right. and super yacht sounds much more fancy.
Okay, so no problems there. That's good.
Yeah.
Take that
so
one off.
Do you understand what kind of market share they have?
17%.
All right.
Of the global market.
Of the global market.
Chunky.
Mm. And how do they do things differently compared to other super yacht painters?
They've got scale. It's a fragmented business, and they've got the capacity now to actually go around snapping up smaller companies to bring it into the fold. As I said, you know, 17% is the biggest company in the field, and I'd rather have the market leader than a tiddler up against the market leader that's got better economies of scale. So the size here is important, because the bigger the size, the bigger the financial stability of a company, the more serious boatyard owners are going to take you when you say, hey, I've got a super yacht coming in worth 400 million euros. I'm going to paint it.
You get Dale Boy and Rodney along.
So that's another tick.
Okay. Other factors?
The next thing I guess you should look at is when they're coming to market, how much money are they looking to raise and what are they planning to do with this money?
DLG, let's ask the question.
Lonsdale had a big stake. They sold down the stake. But equally, you've got to look at who was buying it and the type of fund managers and their track records. So I don't want schmucks buying the equity off a private equity firm just because, you know, they're attracted by the PR. That's important, the track record of the fund manager actually buying into the float. It's also the track record of the broker floating the business too.
And what about the PE house? What about the original backer? I mean,
they retain 19%, so they've got skin in the game.
But I guess if you look at, you know, I think you explore in the feature, and I helped Emma put a little bit together on PE-backed flotations, that they have a reputation for kind of dumping stuff on the market.
Yeah, they kind of went through the 90s phase of where they'd overly indebt a company and then just kind of stick it back on the market.
And there are some horror stories. So I guess if you are looking at the backer, you probably want to see a previous PE owner that A, has continued skin in the game, and B, has a track record of actually offering value to the market.
No, absolutely. But also, I want to see the shareholders buying the stake off the private equity owner to drive the price down to a level that gives upside for external investors as soon as it actually lists. And that's what they did here. They actually drove the price down from the Pathfinder prospectus to what was actually the flotation price quite significantly. So those new shareholders coming aboard said, you know, we're willing to invest at this price, not the price that you want to tout the business at. So they actually did the negotiating for us. So when I went in, I knew that the price being floated was actually an acceptable price.
There's another example you mentioned in the feature of that happening recently, which was Biffa, where the price got driven down. And it's actually been a reasonable IPO since then.
Yeah, and it's not really necessarily the end of the world if that happens. I guess the sort of initial reaction is to think, why is it being driven down so much? What were they underestimating before that now is sort of coming to light?
But it kind of makes
actually
you think,
it can make it more reasonably priced.
But it kind of does make you think there might be something wrong with the business if that negotiation has happened and they're not getting the price they want.
Which is why I had the directors on the telephone for an hour and a half and went through question after question after question with them.
Lucky you, and everyone gets the opportunity to do that. I guess that's what we're here for, I suppose.
We can take vast amounts of information and analyse it and put it into articles of 2,000 words, which are easily read, but having done the legwork first.
Okay. There's another factor that reminds me, which I think is management, which I think
I was going to say,
mentioned.
Simon's point there brings us into the next factor really quite nicely, which is what do you think of the management team and what is their history? Have they tried to float a business in the past and has it worked? Has it not worked?
Their track record with the business they're floating, whether they themselves are invested.
Yeah, are they the founders as well? And how much, and as you say, are they invested now and how much are they going to keep at the end too? Which cannot always be a bad sign if they are planning to sell down. I mean, an example that we talk about in one of the case studies is Fevertree, where the two founders who started the business have sold down their shareholding now is about half of what it was when they came to the market.
Still pretty chunky. I think it was about 12 and 6% for the two founders that they still have
now,
hold of.
That's right. So they still have a significant amount now, but they said that there's just been such overwhelming demand for these shares that they've kind of been forced to sell them down to meet demand from institutional investors.
I mean, that share price has risen an extraordinary lick since it came to market. I mean, you know, these guys, but are they thinking, oh, we've left some value on the table? I do wonder, you know, that you do want to get a fair price for your business. And the Fevertree founders, they didn't get the price that the shares are worth today. I mean, I just think it's quite interesting that, you know, management can be prepared and founders can be prepared to let stuff go, perhaps at a price they know is below its intrinsic value.
But also in the case of Fevertree, the business has evolved quite dramatically since it floated. And
do you think the fact that it floated has helped it grow in the way that it has?
Oh, yeah. The PR that it's had, you know, every time you pick up your newspaper, it's Fevertree has done this, Fevertree has done that, or you're talking about specialist gins. You know, you're getting a lot of PR that ordinarily you wouldn't get if it wasn't listed on the stock market. But also it's hit the markets just at the right time with this gin craze, where you've got gin clubs now, another relative.
Gin club? Where? Where do I sign up?
Well, I will get you details. A cousin of my wife, Wendy, pays £50 a month to be a member of one of these gin clubs.
You're not paying that.
I'm told it's very good, but...
what do you do at a gin club?
Oh, no, you don't do anything.
They just send you some gin.
They send you a different bottle of gin every month.
Every month. £50 a month for gin. That's quite a lot of gin.
Well, I think this relative... Well, let's say no more. So basically Fevertree hit the market just as this gin craze was taking off, and also healthy living as well. You know, there's...
That's gin.
No, I mean...
Beer. They do have light tonic.
That's what I have. Sorry.
No, I mean healthy living as the sugar backlash against sweets and sweetie things. So, you know, if you want a healthy tonic drink, then Fevertree may be it. Well, at least the price certainly justifies being a better tonic.
It's 10 times the price of standard Tesco tonic.
But can you taste the difference,
Joel? That's the argument, isn't it?
I think you can. I'm not sure. I think you can.
I think you can.
I feel like you can.
You can, yeah. I don't want to admit it. It's very expensive. I mean, it is interesting in itself, the timing issue, because that's something you explore in the feature as well. This idea of an IPO cycle.
That's right. Like, if certain companies start coming to the market that have done particularly well, some of their competitors that are privately owned companies might think, well, if that company did really well, maybe I should think of going public. But I mean, it's nice to think that way, but it doesn't always work out quite so nicely.
Indeed. So basically what you kind of suggest is that you run the risk of the issues that come later in the cycle in similar types of businesses and industries can be of perhaps deteriorating quality. And because the cycle is taking off, you're possibly paying more for them as well.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, an interesting example of this. I mean, yeah, one company that came very much later than another is ASOS and Boohoo. So ASOS, which is in the magazine this week, and Boohoo, which you've written about. Boohoo came much later. And, you know, I think there was some scepticism around another online retailer, but it's done very well.
Oh, it's done, yeah, exceptionally well. And, I mean, I don't know about ASOS, but I feel like Boohoo, one of the kind of outstanding factors is that they really know their audience quite well. They have a specific age range that they target. They ship quickly, and their styles are appealing to the people that they're wanting to buy from them. So
I don't get it. I'm not the audience.
They make it so easy to shop.
Do they?
Well, I don't mean like Boohoo, but ASOS is just everyone shops from ASOS. Every female. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just so much easier. Free deliveries, free returns. But yeah, then Boohoo is like a slightly different demographic. Bit younger, bit cheaper. So they've got their own little niche.
And they've bought some companies recently, haven't they?
I was going to say, one of the other things that they did really well is that they've just gone on a bit of an acquisition spree. So
this is what they said they were going to do, though.
I think they did. This in their perspective, this was why they were raising money.
And this is, you know, this is something else you have to look out for. I would say when buying IP, you know, very often you're not going to get in on day one because you're not one of the institution investors, so you will be looking to buy into these IPO stories at a point after the IPO
Boohoo,
date.
You've done well to have done it after the IPO.
Yes.
You had a shocking first year.
Yeah.
And so did ASOS.
ASOS had a shocking... Well, it shocking blew up, years, didn't yeah. it? Do you remember that? The Buncefield Oil Fire.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Blew up its warehouse.
Melted there.
But it recovered. That, such is the strength of the trend. But yeah, so you know you'll be looking at these things perhaps later as a private investor. And one thing perhaps you should look at is whether the promises the company's made at IPO or in their prospectus they have actually fulfilled. And mm-hmm. I guess in Boohoo's case that has been the case.
Yeah, and the acquisitions. I mean, the company 21-3 Clothing, which is more commonly known as Pretty Little Thing, that was probably one of their biggest competitors.
I know it well.
they bought one of their biggest competitors, and they've now bought the intellectual property rights for Nasty Gal, another one of their competitors. And so they've been quite good about spotting shares in the market and buying them up.
Good for them. Thank you very much, Judy. It's a really good feature. Lots to get to grips with there. Lots of good case studies that show us how, you know, the companies that have done it well, companies that have done it badly, the things you should be looking out for.
Yes, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Simon, let's quickly head back to your column before we sign off, because I know we've rudely interrupted you there while you were in mid-flow.
Oh, no, that was great. On the theme of IPOs that sometimes don't work out, but in the end could work out, one of the companies I spoke to this week was Mind & Machines. It's a registry of top-level domains. So they own domains like .london, .miami, .bayern, a big one in China, .vip. It's got a great significance, that name, in China. And they're in talks. A investment bank in the US is doing a strategic review, which could actually lead to an offer for the company. People were disappointed this week when they had results that there wasn't any news on that. I had the finance director and boss on the phone, and they basically assured me something, you know, will happen by the end of the year. Either an offer will be made, or they'll actually walk away from it. Bearing in mind they're in ongoing discussions at the moment, you've got to be able to value this business. And in the third quarter, they achieved $6 million worth of sales. But the key thing to note is that the CEO said this will be their first year of profitability. And it's not just a slight bit of profitability, it's major. FinCap, the analyst there, expects pre-tax profits of roughly $3.7 million. It's actually hit an inflection point. For the first time ever, its renewal billings for these domains that it owns actually exceeds its operating costs. And when you actually hit that point, your incremental sales thereafter, a higher percentage of those sales are actually dropping down to the bottom line. And going through the numbers with the analyst on this, the company's got roughly, or will have roughly 1.5 million domains under management at the end of this year. He values each one at approximately £51 per domain, based on a renewal fee per domain of $8 a domain. And it's like an annuity income stream this is generating. So basically 1.5 million domains times by $8 renewal fees, $12 million worth of income. And as I said, it's actually covered its fixed costs. So a high percentage of that is actually dropping down to the bottom line. And he basically values the stock at over 15 pence compared with 11 pence share price at the moment. I go further than that. A Chinese private equity group took a stake last year at 13 pence. That's actually the biggest Chinese equity group in the country. I actually value it at 18.
Right. Plenty of upside there.
Masses there. Of upside.
Excellent. One more company that I was intrigued about, I'd not heard of it before, Cambridge Cognition. And this kind of taps into the trend we were talking about earlier around the aging population and the proliferation of care homes. This is kind of related to that.
Yeah, they do cognitive assessments to improve the understanding, diagnosis and treatment of neurological and psychological diseases. A great example of this is some technology that they've adapted, which for people with Parkinson's disease or certain other neurological diseases, first shows itself in your voice. So they've actually created software that can actually pick up these disorders. And that's still in development, but expect news on that soon. And given the problems that we're actually seeing, you know, the growth in people with Alzheimer's now, anything that can actually pick up diseases of that kind at an early stage are well worth having.
But it's the kind of thing as well that takes costs out of the whole system, yeah, and that's exactly what we're looking for.
Treating Alzheimer's and all the neurological conditions, they're just caught so late because symptoms show years after they've... years after the illness has taken hold, and then that's why all these Alzheimer's drugs are failing, because they're just given too late. So yeah, if you can diagnose years early, that's fantastic and lots of potential.
I know, totally agree with that. One of my friends has got Parkinson's disease, and this software would actually pick it up as well, this voice software that they're actually developing. I had a great conversation with the finance director and chief executive on this. I put the readers in earlier this year, back in April. I mean, the stock's done fantastically well since then. So it was a case of, is there more upside to this? And I've advised running profits on it.
Is it making money?
Oh, yes, no, it is making money. It's one of these highly operationally geared businesses. They've actually grown the business into the technology that they've got, so actually monetizing it, commercializing it. So when they hit that inflection point of actually turning profitable, a higher percentage of incremental revenues drop straight down to the bottom line. So this year, profits will quadruple to £500,000. Next year, they're forecast to double to £1 million or thereabouts. Well, not a huge increase in revenues, because the revenue assumptions are quite conservative. But the point is, once you've actually covered your fixed cost base and you've actually developed the technology and you're actually out doing the deals to actually sell it, their big clients, big pharma in clinical trials, that's what they do. But when you actually hit that point where you actually turn profitable with a business with such valuable IP, the margins you can make thereafter are high. I mean, their gross margin is 90%, John.
No, it's quite interesting. I mean, you're already making money in, you know, what is a growth area, without a shadow of a doubt. Tech-enabled healthcare.
It's quite unusual for a small tech/ healthcare company to be making money.
I like the look of this one. Tech-enabled healthcare. We have talked about this before. We'll talk about it again.
Yeah, it's a very interesting topic.
Okay, I think we've run up against the clock, unfortunately. Thank you, everybody, for your contributions today. Thank you, Julia. Thank you, Simon. And thank you, Megan. Plenty more in the magazine. It's been another incredibly busy week on the results front. I'm going to probably start calming down from here on out. Thank goodness. But we will be busy until Christmas sorting out features and such alike. Alex Newman's done the stock screen. Alex Newman's put together the stock screen this week. High quality large caps, one of our better performing screens. In fact, most of them perform very well, but this one is a very, very consistent performer. Lots of the personal finance and fund section, which they will talk about on their podcast tomorrow. All the usual tips and comments. And that's it. Thank you all again. Thank you for listening. How to Profit from Stock Market Newcomers IPO. It's a nice cover this week. Very, very bright and bold. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back again next week. See you later.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.